Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 31st, 2014. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:31 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Michicki, Senator Bishop, and myself, the Chair, Senator Giesel. I know Senator French will be joining us shortly. Senator Dyson, the Vice Chair, has a bill up in another committee. Senator McGuire is on her way, and Senator Fairclough is excused for today. Recording Secretary, Ann Kreckelberg. Thanks, Ann. And Juno LIO is Claire Gross. Thanks, Claire. And my staff, Lindsay Williams, is keeping us on track here. So today we are having two items coming up. The first one is an informational presentation on the opportunities for resource development to address economic challenges in rural Alaska. And then at about 4:30, we're going to transition to hearing HJR 30, Eisenbeck Land Exchange. So we're going to open up by showing a video, a movie. So I'll have my staff cue it up.
Hi, my name is Tim Eaton. I'm director of the Villages documentary that you're about to see. In 2012, when we started this project, I knew almost nothing about Alaska. And in February of last year on a frozen lake, I learned a couple of things very quickly. One, cold in Alaska means cold, very cold. And two, there's a kind of raw beauty about Alaska. It's rugged, it's austere, and it's very unique in the world, very inspiring. And three, it takes a special kind of person to live in rural Alaska. You have to be tough, and you have to have strong character. Our goal in this project was to capture life in Southwest Alaska as it really is. No constraints. And so what you're about to see is what we learned in almost a year of shooting and many trips back to the villages. There's no narrator in the film. We decided to let the people of the villages do their own talking, tell their own story. In the course of making the film, we made a lot of very good friends, and we met a lot of courageous people. The Villages documentary is a tribute to them. Enjoy.
My people have lived here for thousands of years, and we were always taught respect. Respect for each other, respect for the land, and respecting everything, because everything is connected. What you do each day affects more than just yourself. The mountains have been there for a long time, and they've had a lot of wisdom, and we respect that. So when we go on the mountain, we're not conquering it, we're like a guest, so to speak, and that's how we then hit our...
survive on beauty alone in pristine wilderness, we would be the wealthiest people in the world. The challenges are finding a way to sustain ourselves in this beautiful country.
I like living in the bush because there's more freedom. You can do what you want to do, and you have country to get out and away from it all in, and you can hunt, fish, and pick berries, and live like you want to live.
I like the fact that it's untouched. I can go out here places and I can't walk in places nobody else has ever walked.
I love this place, and it's, I guess it's difficult to put it into words, but I feel connected to the land and to everything more than I do anywhere else. And I never wanted to live anywhere else, I mean, but here. You had to be tough And you had to be smart to live here. And growing up, when the lake or rivers opened up, we'd be told to go and take a swim. And we like put the meat on your bones, go out and make yourself tough. So that's how we were taught.
I remember many times my mother helping butcher a moose and put it away, or we would be out ice fishing, because that was dinner that night. If we didn't get a moose, if we didn't get a fish, we wouldn't have had food to eat.
People here will still practice this, what people call subsistence. It's just a way of life, and try to live off the land as much as we can. For my family, subsistence also means continuing the tradition that we pass on to our grandkids, and plus the food itself, like our fish, accounts for about a third of our diet.
That is the main conscious
outbreak. The fish camp is a big part of all our lives because everybody puts up their winter fish. Especially with the prices of everything these days, winter fish is a big part of our food supply, so we really depend on our fish. And it's been going on for generations and generations.
When we're talking about subsistence, we're really talking about two different things. Traditionally, subsistence was what it took to survive. So you were harvesting from the land in order to have food for yourself and for your family. You needed those things to live. I think most often now when we refer to subsistence, what we're really talking about is traditional use and cultural heritage. Both very important things, but not really the same thing as it used to be, where that was the food that you had to have to survive. You could certainly hike out to get your moose or your firewood, but of course it's a lot easier if you have a boat or a snowmobile and chainsaws rather than handsaws. I don't know anybody that is currently living a completely old-fashioned subsistence lifestyle, nor do I know anybody that would probably like to go back to that.
In the early days, we would cut birch poles into blocks that would burn in our stove. We didn't buy fuel oil. We didn't spend cash for energy resource back then. Today is a different world. I still cut wood, but I use a $10,000 snowmobile. I have a $1,200 sled, a $300 chainsaw, $8 gallon gas, and I go out in the woods and get this free heat. It's just not the same, because all of the things that we use today to provide for that energy for our home cost money.
Everything is flowing in here, and we're about 180 miles southwest of Anchorage, so about an hour flight or a little more. Everything comes that way, whether it's medicine that you need urgently or fuel or supplies. All of these things come by air, and so it's a challenge.
The reason why we fly fuel to the villages, heating oil and motor fuel, is because they're so remote, there's no roads to get it there any other way. Generally, we carry about 4,470 gallons of heating oil. We go to most of the remote destinations in Alaska. It is substantially harder to live out here.
Nowadays, you have to have money. We've been forced to move into a cash economy. So we're looking for ways to buy the gas and shells and nets and whatever we need to live off the land.
Back when I first moved here, we didn't have electricity, we didn't have running water, we had to pack water. It didn't cost much to live here or any of the villages. Now everybody's got a lot of bills. In fact, the average cost is probably $2,000 to $3,000 a month people live here. It's changed, and things are going to have to change to accommodate that.
It's good to hang on to the old ways, you know, like, you know, we're proud of that, you know. But to live in like in those days is just impossible.
One of the huge dynamics historically in our region is when the governments mandated schooling. and they would come into a region and they would build a facility for schooling, and the law required that the students would attend this school. And so instead of being nomadic and opportunistic and following the fish, the game, the opportunities seasonally, everyone was basically forced to live near the school.
In the state of Alaska, there has to be 10 students enrolled to keep a school open. If you go under 10 students, they'll close the school and then the community just kind of dries up and moves away. It's a matter of economics. In Igigik, for instance, for the last 5 years, we've barely made the count. So we live from year to year hoping we have enough children to keep the school open, because if the school closes, the community essentially will just disappear.
I don't see no sense with, you know, really surviving without school. If you know, us elders, you know, we could be there, you know, but there's no younger people to carry on, you know, the village, you know, keep it alive like all the time we were doing, you know. So I think school is a very, very important thing in the village.
Population is decreasing because the people can't afford to live in the villages anymore. Our villages are drying up. And if something doesn't change, a third of our villages could be gone. And I just don't want to see that.
You can't get a job, and they want to move, they want to stay, but there's nothing to move to, and nothing to stay. So what do you do? You know, you end up, you know, being a friend that, you know, I hate to say this, but they, you know, just alcohol and drugs, you know, they get on that.
But the problem is that there's no jobs. Men don't have, you can't stand up and say, hey, I'm a man, I got pride, I'm putting food on my table and stuff like that. I'm waiting for that first of the month check, and once I get that, I'm just going to drink because I ain't got nothing else to do. I know, because I've been there before. I've been there and I've done that.
People live on welfare or other government handouts. When you live like that, you lose your dignity, your pride. You don't feel like a whole person. It's a great challenge living in our villages without an opportunity to work. Our people are not lazy. They're hardworking people, but there's no opportunity. And it's very difficult to ask our young people to leave home so they can find a job.
The future of the villages is so-so. The fishing industry has always been a mainstay and is very important to all of us. The salmon runs kind of come and go. They go through cycles where the fishing is so bad, people sell off their permits, or fishing is so hot, everybody tries to get into it. As far as any other kind of economy, it's not very good, and it seems to me that the villages in general are dwindling.
In the past, we used to fish in Bristol Bay, so that, you know, made most of the money for us, you know, fishing. But they started this permit thing, and some of the people got permits and some of them didn't. So fishing is not really not making us the money that we need.
We're in Bristol Bay region of Alaska, the Naknek-Kujik fishing district, out about 6-7 miles from the mouth of the Naknek River. See if we can't catch a few fish.
Okay, throw it out.
Everybody thinks that we all have commercial fish up here. Well, it's not. You have to have a fishing permit to be able to fish down in the bay. Since 1980, residents of the Lake and Peninsula Borough have lost or sold over 60% of all the fishing permits in the region. So less than half the people now can fish that used to be able to fish. So fishing doesn't support us anymore.
Maybe. Put the net line over that side.
because of that and high unemployment, I'm obligated to, you know, if there's something in view of our near future of economic opportunity, we need to look at that.
Thank you.
I believe this area has incredible potential. I think it's very critical that we get on the side of being producers, not just people that are taking from the government.
I'd like to see that happen in all the communities, that they all become self-sustaining, which is the need to diversify, to get some other way of a cash economy besides being totally dependent on fishing or government.
I think outside money is the key to, especially a small village, the key to sustainability. We just have to accept the fact that we have to find a way to bring outside money and business into our communities to have economic viability.
I originally decided I wanted to work for Pebble because, well, first of all, it was something that I could do, but mainly I kept hearing these reports in the media, and some of them just didn't make sense to me. Well, what better way to find out what's actually happening out there than to be out there with the consultants and to see what's happening and to see if they are respecting my land.
The Pebble Mine project is a big deal in our region. I haven't really made up my mind whether I'm for it or against it. I just want to see what they plan to do, and then I can evaluate it. But I do appreciate the money that Pebble has spent on the science. The baseline information to me is valuable, incredibly valuable. That's the most studied piece of ground in the state, if not further beyond.
I own a hunting and fishing lodge, and I've created my living by bringing people from outside of Alaska up here to enjoy the ambiance and tranquility of Alaska. And a hole in the ground probably is not, you know, is not not what we're going to be looking for.
I'm not for the Pebble Project per se. I'm for the science and the engineering because it has the potential to bring hope to the villages. If we just throw the baby out with the bathwater, then a lot of chances for our young people goes away. A lot of hope for jobs and hope for the future goes away. So economic value equals hope in my eyes. And so I want this emotionalism to go away. I want the process to continue.
There's many of my very good friends who are dead set against building the Pebble Project. And they're vocal about it. We have great discussions about it. I'm not for building the project. I'm for letting the process continue to see what's offered. Many of them are ready to jump right now on the bandwagon and say, let's just stop it right now. Don't even investigate.
When I first started, Pebble first came around, I had my No Pebble stuff up. I had my banners up. I had all of that up. But then one day, Val and I woke up and we were looking at each other and said, you know, we got to start learning both sides of it. There's always both sides to every story.
I don't want to give up caribou hunting or moose hunting or fishing or berries to let people dig a hole in the ground. If they can't do it right, I would be very opposed to it. But if they can show me that they can, then I'm willing to listen and look at the plans.
I'm in favor of a full study of every opportunity that comes our way, and in the end, we can decide whether or not it should go or won't go. If a operator can get a license, then they can go to work. If they can't get a license, they don't go to work.
If the science comes back and says that this mine can be built and that it can be safe in perpetuity, to be honest with you, it probably needs to be allowed to be brought into production in a safe manner. Doesn't mean that we all have to like it, but if we expect to have that same latitude in our own businesses, I don't think it's fair to deny that to other businesses.
We don't have tourism anymore. We don't have any industry. The sport fishing industry never did really help us out by hiring any local people.
What else is there? There's some government jobs, state jobs, but These are very few. So if this mine can be done safely, then I think it should be done.
They're creating jobs that some of these kids wouldn't get a chance to do, which is a good thing, because you got to quit doing drugs and you got to cut back on your alcohol just to get a job. So with these young kids going down there and working and coming back, you could see they're getting their self-pride back. And you could see that they're providing for their families. A lot of people see that, but they still don't like what they see, but it's there, and those kids are actually making their own living. I think that's pretty cool.
Now, in a world age where we can't get along much anymore, and more like depending on our kids mostly, and that's why I want my kids to, you know, get a job and work and make money, and they don't have to struggle like we did when we were younger. So hopefully all of them would have some sort of dreams to look forward to.
Our time is up. I mean, whatever we're talking about now is not for us. It's for the future generation, for them to, you know, have something to look forward to.
My dream village would have healthy families, happy children, happy adults, respect for the elders and the children, everybody working to take care of themselves and others. It just would be so satisfying to see that happening again. And they are tired of the hopelessness and the futility of being sidelined all the time. So, and the Native community has been survivors for thousands of years, and I think it's time we got past surviving and started accomplishing things again.
My dream for the village is that everybody start coming back. There's jobs being created and people start coming back. People be happy to be home. Not just to come home and do the fish camp thing and go right back to Anchorage. Come home to be home. That's one of my biggest dreams.
My dream for this place is to have these villages grow in a positive way where people can have a meaningful job or employment and still be able to go out in the country and get a moose and fish through the ice or get salmon when they come up. Not from day to day wondering where your next meal is going to come from.
That's my dream.
Wanted everyone to have the opportunity to see that film and really hear from people that live out in Southwest Alaska. Of course, today is Seward's Day, and William Seward knew that Alaska was rich in resources and would certainly be beneficial to the state of Alaska, but we have resources that we can develop in these areas that create jobs and support families. So that's what I wanted to highlight today. We are joined by former Commissioner John Shively. Welcome, John. He has, of course, been very involved in the Pebble Project, to say the least. And I've invited him to come and present the views of the fact that this is about people. Certainly the minerals are important, but ultimately this is about people. So welcome, John. If you would introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is John Shively. I'm chairman of the board of the Pebble Limited Partnership. And I want to do a couple things today. First thing probably I should do is say that the movie you just saw, we did pay for. But when we told Tim, when you go out and you find your story, we had no editorial control over that. He did the movie. He found what he found. And to be perfectly frank, he's told us that he has clips in there that are much more difficult about what's going on in the region than he ended up showing. But I think it does give a picture that I'm going to sort of expand on here in a few minutes. So I'll try to run through this, and then if you have any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them. So, first of all, I want to talk about the project. I mean, it is a big project. It's a world-class prospect. It's on state land. It's a state asset. We asked IHS Global Insight last year, an internationally well-known economics consulting firm, to do an economic study for us. They estimate that, you know, during construction, the direct, indirect, and imputed jobs will be over 4,000 and over 2,000 during operations, of 1,000 of those just direct jobs right at the mine. It will have an impact on the economy. We'll spend over $400 million a year during the 4 to 5 years of construction, and at least in the first 25 years, probably over $1 billion a year in the Alaska economy just to operate this mine. People talk about state revenues and whether mining pays or doesn't pay, and we don't have to have that debate today, but we will be a significant taxpayer, not oil. That's mining doesn't bear that kind of taxation, but we think that we can contribute over $100 million a year in taxes, which by our calculation is more than the entire commercial fishing industry is currently contributing to the state coffers. And that we will have a royalty. Part of that royalty will go into the permanent fund because we are on state lands. We've said all along that, you know, if the state wants to look at mining taxes and royalties and have a discussion about it at some point, when we have a better idea of what the mine is going to be, we've always been willing to do that. I want to spend a little time. This is a tough slide, so I don't want you to sort of concentrate on all of the little lines. But this slide was made up from a table that was in the Department of Labor's Economic Trends magazine, which former Commissioner Bishop is actually one of the best things that state produces, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of getting people information. And what this shows is the change in population by census district from 2000 to 2010. And I know it will come as no surprise to you that as you go to the left and you look at rural census districts, the population has been declining. Two of the three areas in the Bristol Bay region, the Lake and Peninsula Borough, and the Bristol Bay Borough, which is at the end of a couple of the largest decreases. Dillingham, which is over here, had a slight increase. But if you look at, and this really has a lot of implications, not for Pebble, but for what, for, you know, the state as you consider state policy. So in those 10 years, the native population grew 11.6% in the state. In no rural district was the population gain that high. The closest it came to it was Wade Hampton out in the Yukon-Kuskokwim area, which increased population by 8.3%. And, of course, what was very dramatic to me is the native population in the Matsu Borough, which increased 63% in those 10 years. But, you know, for me, a lot of what my work has been in the last 6 years is, and it'll be 6 years in 2 days, has been concentrating on the three census districts that I talked to you about, the Bristol Bay Borough, the Lake and Peninsula Borough, and the Dillingham census area. And this is just another quote about, similar to what you saw in the movie, about the fact that there aren't not economic opportunities out there. And people have said, well, gee, John, you know, there's a $1.5 billion commercial fishing industry in that region, which there is, you know, and I recognize that, and I certainly have no interest in damaging that industry. But when you look at the impact on what it does locally, it has changed. When limited entry went in, over 80% of the limited entry permits, both DriftNet and SetNet, were owned by people that lived in the region. Now, as you can see, DriftNet, which is generally the people that make more money, 59% of them are owned by people that don't live in the state. The SetNet permit, it's about one-third local, one-third other Alaskan, and one-third outside. And then If you look, I mean, and this is one of the things that's really annoyed me about some of our opposition. They talk about, and they change the numbers all the time, and sometimes it's 12,000, sometimes it's 14,000, sometimes it's 16,000 jobs that are connected with the industry. Well, yeah, there are that many jobs, but they're very short-term jobs. They're mostly in the processing area. They're mostly 6 to 8 week jobs. They're low wage. And this, again, comes from the State Department of Labor. Over 80% of them generally are held by non-residents, many of them actually non-citizens of the U.S., because they're not good working conditions, and because some of that occurs when people are also active in their subsistence lifestyle. And that has resulted in schools closing, as I talked about in the movie. So since 2003, there have been six schools closed, but four of those schools have closed in the last 3 years. So the rate of school closure is increasing, and there are a number of other schools that are right on the edge of closing. One school I know particularly borrowed a student from another village to get their 10 students. Villages are recruiting teachers with children, or VPSOs with children, to keep those numbers above 10. You know, we've spent a lot of time with elders. We've had an elders conference. We had an elders advisory committee. And, you know, their visions aren't much different than, I think, a lot of people's in some ways. I mean, of course, they have a better tie to subsistence. They have a particular culture in rural Alaska that's very important to them. I've spent a fair amount of time in rural Alaska, and I think I'm very sensitive to that. But they also, as the movie pointed out, I mean, things have changed. And so, you know, one of the things we hear more and more in our elders conference is it's about jobs. How can we keep our children in the villages? What opportunities can there be for them? This quote came from a young woman, Janessa Woods, who's one of our employees. This quote came last August when Gina McCarthy, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, had a community meeting in New Halen. There are no other job opportunities, absolutely none. If Pebble weren't here, I'd probably be on welfare, probably be on food stamps, probably be on energy. So, you know, to me, although it is about jobs in some ways, and it's about taxes, but it's about what it can do for local people. And I've seen that. I mean, in the last several years, we've employed between 130 and 180 local people. You know, people have said, and I've heard this many times, in fact, we heard it when we were doing Red Dog, and some of you know I worked at NANA when we did Red Dog. You know, they told us, well, you know, natives don't have any mining background. They won't take the jobs. They won't like the jobs. They won't keep the jobs, all of that. Well, of course, at Red Dog, the workforce has always been over 50% Alaska Native. Our biggest problem in the region was not recruiting Alaska Natives. Our biggest problem was people calling up our local hire person and talking to her and crying on the phone because they needed work. So we had many more people who wanted to work than could work. And just one example, there's a young man named Jonathan Hobson who was, when I first met him, when I first came on the job as CEO, he was a driller's helper. He was very shy. He's from the village of Nolan Dalton. If we brought press people out, he would go hide. He didn't want to talk to them. About 2 years ago, we brought some press people out, and he came up to us and he said, look, I want to talk to those people. I want to tell them what the job means to me, what it means to my family, what I can do now in the wintertime. I can feed my family. I can buy a new snow machine. It has changed my life. And really, that's what, to me, Pebble is about. That's why I took the job. I mean, you know, I'm not there because I have an interest in the world supply of copper, although I've become more interested in that, I must admit. But I'm there because I spent a lot of my career working to try to find opportunities in rural Alaska. And this is a huge opportunity. These opportunities do not come along often. And so, you know, if I believed, as our opposition does, that we would do the damage to the fishery that people have said we would do, I wouldn't be sitting here in front of you today. And I didn't know whether we would do that or not when I first took the job, and I told both Anglo-American and Northern Dynasty that. But I've been there almost 6 years. I do know we can build this prospect without damaging the fishery in the way people have said. I also know that if we were going to do that kind of damage, we'd never get through the permitting process, particularly on the federal side, but I don't think on the state side either. I mean, the state permitting process, which comes under attack from time to time, you know, has always done a good job of protecting the fishery. That's why we have a vibrant fishery. So, you know, all we've ever asked for really is to say, okay, let us design this project. And it's a complicated project. It is a large mine. It is a transportation system that could be a train, could be a road and pipelines. It's a large port. It's 500 megawatts of power. And every time we change one little thing on it, we change another. But we have spent $150 million on our science. We believe we can engineer a project that works, and we still intend ultimately to bring it into the permitting process, assuming the Environmental Protection Agency will let us. So with that, I'm happy to stop, and if anybody wants to ask questions, I'm pleased to try to answer them.
Great. Thank you very much, John. Questions from committee members? Senator Dyson.
I have an anomaly. It's a hypersensitive sense of fairness, and people who overstate things tend to lose credibility with me, and although I'm an enthusiast and tend to overstate things that are to me, and I probably said to you, or maybe even said to you, John, I told you 1,000 times, quit exaggerating. But anyways, flown over much of that country and, of course, fished Bristol Bay for 25 years. And as I remember the topography, where the mine is, there's a creek that comes out of there that drains. It would be kind of west and ends up finally down towards the Nooshigak. And another one that comes probably be southeast and ends up over in the Lake Iliamna drainage. Is that right?
Yeah, they're basically three creeks. There's Upper Tularik that sort of starts on the northern part, but and then parallels the prospect, but on the other side of a small mountain, and empties into Lake Iliamna, and then the Kwijak, and then South Fork of the Koktulik sort of starts in Frying Pan Lake, which is sort of at the end of the valley that the prospect is in. That connects with the North Fork of the Koktulik, and the Koktulik goes to the Chatna that goes into the Nooshigak.
And the third creek?
Well, North and South Forks of the Koktulik are the other two.
Okay.
So Upper Tularik, North and
right.
South Forks.
So I hear the opponents say a catastrophe at this mine could ruin the bay, you know, the whole fishery. And there's five major rivers that flows in here: Ugashik, Igigik, Naknak, Kwijak, and Nooshigak. Did I miss one? The American River comes in, I think.
Yeah, and I think there are eight different watersheds, but you've got the major ones.
Yeah. So, all right. So I have been saying, even if the worst happens, it's not going to destroy the fishery. And my experience over 25 years was that even when one run gets really weak, that the fish are not quite as good at navigating, and they'll often get into drainages that smell like home, and then they'll with red salmon and kings, with red salmon, they can be out in the ocean 1, 2, or 3 ocean seasons before they come home, and we like the third season one because they're bigger and fatter. But so then if you lose a year, It will replenish just because of the apparent randomness of when they choose to head for home. All right. So I was saying something close to true.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the example I like to use, and I didn't use it in this presentation, but some of my presentations these days, I have a volcano going off to replicate what happened with Katmai, where there was a huge volcanic explosion, very toxic material, closed off a number of streams. The fish came back ultimately. In Mount St. Helens, you had the same kind of effect. Some of the streams there have come back naturally, but others have come back because man stepped in and fixed them. And same thing in Prince William Sound, where the Forest Service went in and fixed streams that were affected by the 64 earthquake. So, yeah, if something went wrong, could there be a short-term impact? The answer is yes. Would it devastate the fishery? I don't believe so, and I don't think there's anybody that can show that it would. The other thing to keep in mind is, you know, this is a low-grade prospect. Yeah, we move a lot of ore, but it averages less than 1%. So a lot of what we're producing as waste is really just dirt. over 90%, about 90% of what we put in the tailings impoundment facility will be just dirt.
Follow-up, Senator Jason?
Yeah, I don't want people to think I'm here being a straight man making your case for you. But you've been in a very unique position over a long, long period of time. Comment on how do we make and keep an attractive place for people to come and risk a lot of money on projects. And it would seem to me if I was an investor looking at Alaska with a lot of rich resources and I saw a very rich prospect and people who were investing in it went through a laborious process to get permitted to just explore, and they'd spent, what did you say, $125 million or something?
$150 just on it. We've spent over $600 million all together.
Okay, and so they've expended $600 million, and the process that they'd bought into in good faith got sawed off, you know, by something that would be difficult to figure on in a business plan, that will have some chilling effect on other investors. I realize I'm feeding you a softball, but...
I think I can handle that one, Senator. Well, I mean, the Fraser Institute, who does an annual survey of mining industry executives, and they measure a variety of different aspects of mining. And so the good news for Alaska is we are number one in the world in terms of geological prospects. But if you look at our permitting process and things like that, we fall down. And our average, the average grade for everything, we're 23rd in the world. And, of course, we're more expensive, so that doesn't happen. We've actually fallen the last couple of years, and that's largely driven by the challenges of getting through the permitting process.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. So you might just help me on this. And so there's a 2008 statewide effort that was defeated at the polls about the mine, essentially. And then they narrowed it down to the 2011 Save Our Salmon Initiative, which passed by 37 votes, which was recently struck down. What causes people to... what do you think is the primary reason that the people of Southwest have become so concerned without first wanting the mine to go through there? Because I've seen some of the sensationalism that occurs on some of these efforts. And, you know, there's some legitimate concerns. There's no question about that. But I've been through parts of the region. I know some of the economic challenges. What drives people to cut something off at the knees or to attempt to cut something off at the knees before really can evaluate the effects?
Well, Senator Chickie, through the chair, I have some theories on that. I don't know. I mean, clearly our opposition has done a very good job of persuading people that we will do significant damage to the fishery. And the efforts by the EPA to do a study on a mine that doesn't exist has certainly added to that problem. We have, and I don't want to get into this, but we have lots of evidence that that whole thing was driven from the inside, not the outside, as EPA has maintained. I mean, I've told people out there, and I have friends, very good friends that I've known for, you know, over 30 years that are opposed to what we're trying to do, that they need to be concerned. I don't have any problem with people being concerned. That's important. But, you know, there are people that are being paid to oppose us, just like I'm being paid to support the mining prospect. There's a lot of concern and fear in rural Alaska now because of just what's going on out there. This whole idea of what's happening in the villages, people are afraid because they see it. And so I think fear is something that's easy to spread. But, you know, I've seen, you know, in our elders, I saw a couple elders who, when we started the elders conference 5 years ago, were absolutely opposed to the mine, who changed their mind, said, look, we need to look at this. We need to look at this opportunity. Our last elders conference, the whole conversation almost, once the elders started talking about themselves, was what was going on in the village? What can we do for our kids? How can we keep them there? And so I really think over time we can change them. That, and of course, what's interesting to me is the most support we have, where we have a lot of support, are people that actually live closest to the mining prospect. And most of our opposition are people in Dillingham that live over 100 miles away.
Interesting. Other questions? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. John, you made a... I have been around the peripheral edges of this project since inception, before I was ever Commissioner of Labor in my other life, specifically at Iliamna doing some workforce development training on an airport project. And I see Myrtle and Elon's name here, and it was a deja vu moment for me, this, as I was out there training locals for an airport project. And you are right. No doubt about it. And you mentioned they can do the work. No question. Red Dog, you had mentioned, you know, they're in the 51-55% shareholder hire. That's accurate. But I was there during construction. And my job was to train locals on how to operate heavy equipment. And we had a 77% placement of Nana shareholders on that project. So... skills and ability, they're just screaming for an opportunity, period. And I just want to go back to, you'd think I'm your straight guy here talking to Senator Dyson, but I just got to go back to this slide here where you got the three guys on the drill rig here. And some of these people here sitting at the table believed enough in me to support me on a project to start working with the industry, not just your company, but other companies, to start the first ever registered core driller apprenticeship training program on the planet.
Yeah, and it was a very successful program.
So actually, these three guys can take these skill sets, they can pick them up, and they can, and they're portable. You know, so just give them an opportunity. Okay. So, but I want to go back to one other thing. I'm sorry, ma'am.
Senator, could I just respond?
Sure.
Through the chair. Yeah, I mean, Jonathan Hobson, the gentleman I mentioned, he started out as a driller's helper and became a driller because of that program that you helped found. So it was a very successful program.
So one of the early on, so you just said 1%, you know, you talked about most of the material going in to the dam will be overburdened. Did I hear one?
No, it's confusing. What goes behind the tailings impoundment facility is the waste stream that comes out of the processing plant. We call that tailings.
Right.
And what I said was that a little over 90% of that is just dirt. It doesn't. There is some pyritic tailings that come out that do have sulfide. They will be handled in a separate stream, placed in a separate part of the tailings impoundment facility so that they don't come in contact with air and water both, which makes sulfuric acid. But most of it's just dirt.
You don't even know if you have a project yet. You're just trying to permit this to see if you... I mean, you're just trying to do the analytical science to see if you even have a project.
Correct.
Okay. So one of the... years ago, there was some discussion about maybe this could be an underground project, an underground mine with a slurry pipeline to tidewater, and it's processed somewhere else. That's come and gone, probably.
Well, Senator, through the chair... I mean, there are two parts of the prospect. Preble West, which clearly has to be an open pit, and it probably would where we'd start. And Pebble East, which is richer and further down, could be underground. The problem with going underground, it takes a significant investment to get down there, over $1 billion just to get started, and we'd be done by a blockade. But you'd still have the same tailings impoundment. You'd still process at the mine site. The problem with moving the ore to processing it in another area, and we have looked at that, let's say, on the Cook Inlet side, which wouldn't make Peter's constituents very happy, is that because it is only 1% and less mineralization, you have to move a lot of stuff that has absolutely no value. So if you go underground, you still have the water treatment that we would have. You'd still have a tailings impoundment facility, just like the open pit. The thing that you would probably not have is the waste rock piles from the overburden.
Thank you.
Good. You know, I wanted to have Deputy Commissioner Fogles talk about the permitting process. You can stay there, John, that's fine, in case there's other questions. But I wonder if we could have Deputy Commissioner Fogles come up. What I asked him to do is if he could give us a broad brush overview of how DNR would approach, or does approach, a large mine permitting process.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And I actually, my thought process is going to start off a little bit different, but then I'll circle back to the specifics. But I just wanted to start off by saying that there are two myths out there that I continually hear that just will not go away. And I think I want to start off with those two myths and try and inject a little bit of truth into those. And one is that mines don't contribute to the state's economy, and two is that mines can't be permitted properly. And I think it's really clear, if you look at Alaska's record, that we've done a pretty darn good job with our mining industry from an environmental perspective, and our mines are indeed significant economic contributors to our state's economy, especially in those rural regions that are fortunate enough to have one of these mines in close proximity. The Red Dog Mine successfully operated for many years now is one of the world's largest zinc mines. It's the main economic driver of the Northwest Arctic Borough. And the water that leaves that mine is treated and has a lower metals content than the naturally occurring waters, and the fish populations are growing downstream. The Kensington and Greens Creek mines, those are both strong economic drivers of the economy of Juneau, and they are operating soundly. Fort Knox is a significant contributor to the Fairbanks community. They've created wetlands downstream with growing fish populations. Usabelli Coal Mine provides over 100 jobs to the rural community of Healy and has been successfully reclaiming its lands for over 50 years now. And the Pogo Mine provides jobs for Delta Junction, Fairbanks, and is operating in the headwaters of one of the most pristine and beautiful rivers in the interior, the Good Pastor River. The state's got a large mine team that's composed of experts from all the different agencies. They're mining engineers, they're hydrologists, they're biologists, environmental engineers, and more, all with advanced degrees, PhDs and master's level degrees. They've been working on permitting these mines, and they monitor them for environmental compliance. They do regular inspections. They do biomonitoring to make sure the aquatic life downstream of these mines remains healthy. They will continue to monitor these mines as they close, and post-closure, they'll monitor the care and maintenance of these facilities well into the future. The state's large mine team was created over 20 years ago, and it's unique in the nation. It's coordinated by the DNR's Office of Project Management and Permitting. It issues the dozens of permits necessary for a large mine from the state alone, and it coordinates with the federal agencies, which also need to issue dozens of federal permits. It also coordinates with the federal agencies to do the environmental impact statement process, which is really the key driver to permitting any large project, whether it's a mine or anything else in Alaska. Can't do it without the federal agencies involved. No one agency can alone permit a large mine project. We keep hearing that somehow DNR is going to magically permit a mine like Pebble. Can't happen. The denial of any one permit by any major permit by any state or federal agency can effectively kill a project. All of these many agencies have to work together, and all of these experts have to agree that these permits would be issuable for a particular mine. It's a big job. Mining projects, like all big industrial projects, are complex, and they're never without their issues. None of these projects will ever work perfectly. Our jobs are to evaluate those designs and make sure they're strong and robust. And the key is now becoming to make sure the monitoring at each mine site is very, very strong so we can look for potential problems when they're small. And that's the name of the game. Get in there and monitor effectively enough so you can see where something's not working quite right. You can get in there and work with the operator to fix that before it actually turns into a larger problem. And, you know, we've had issues with mines all around the state, and we can sit down with you with every single mine and go through every single issue and explain to you beginning to end how that was found, how that was addressed, how that was fixed, and how procedures were changed so that the likelihood of that happening again is minimal or has been minimized. You know, we have 17, Alaska has 17% of the world's coal, 3.5% of the world's copper, 3% of the world's lead, 8% of the world's gold, 3% of the world's zinc, and 1.5% of the world's silver. We're underexplored, as I think you heard. 15% of all of Alaska has been mapped at an inch to a mile scale in geology, and only 25% of state land has been flown with our geophysical surveys. We have a lot of potential on our state lands alone. That's just on our state lands. That's not including federal lands or Native corporation lands. We have a lot of potential to have these kinds of projects, and they can be done properly. We have the experience to be able to permit these projects, and most importantly, we have the experience to know when something won't work right, and the wisdom and the experience not to approve something when it won't work right. And so I think I kind of went around about how the process works, but I can get into more detail in any particular part of that process. But essentially, I think the big take-home messages are that our agents, state agencies, are your experts. They work for you. They all have significant jobs to do. They have to decide whether to issue their own individual permits. That'll all be part of this coordinated process that will typically take, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 years for a big project. Right now we're in the midst of looking at the permit applications for the Donlin Creek project. If that were to be permitted, that would provide a generation or maybe two generations worth of high-paid jobs for the people of that region. It's a real potential, really bright spot for their economies out in the future. So I guess with that, I just open it up to questions about our permitting process and anything else you guys might want to ask me. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. The average wage in the mining industry in Alaska today is $100,000 a year. So that's pretty amazing. You didn't talk about the health impact assessment that you do, and that's pretty unique. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Yes, Madam Chair. The state of Alaska is unique, I think, in the nation, where we're the only state that has developed a state-led health impact assessment program within the state. That's housed within the Department of Health and Social Services. A number of years ago, there was a call that the federal environmental impact statement process wasn't doing an adequate enough job of analyzing the impacts to human health, focused on the environment, but not enough to human health. And the federal laws that drive the environmental impact statement process actually do mention human health in the laws. So it was decided that more focus should be put on the impacts to human health. So we actually have a medical doctor that's been hired by the Department of Health and Social Services. And his job is to sit on the large projects team. He's one of the many experts that I mentioned that sits on all large projects teams. And his job is to make sure that human health is brought into the equation when we're evaluating the potential impacts, both positive and negative, from a proposed large mine. And again, as I mentioned, I don't think any other state in the nation has evolved a health impact assessment program the way the state has. It's pretty exciting, actually.
Mm, cool. Further questions for either the Deputy Commissioner or Mr. Shively? Yes, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is kind of for both of you. It's kind of more what I was asking earlier, and it's just another question to lead into that. Is, you know, 850,000 comments. You talked about the EPA, sort of an inside thing, but they received 850,000 comments about the project. Pretty amazing number. And we've seen, as we experience here with the HB 77 thing, that there's some legitimate concerns about permitting, but then there are also folks that go out into rural communities, and the way I phrased it in the past is they ask them what monsters are under their bed. And when the native communities tell them or the rural communities tell them, they say, this project does that. And I'm just wondering when we can start having an honest discussion about the impacts of projects. And again, if you can help me with what creates that sensationalism and how do we keep the EPA from either inviting 850,000 comments or how do we educate our communities about actual effects from projects? And, you know, some of them are not going to be right. Some projects are not going to be right from our communities, but it certainly requires a discussion before we make that determination.
Well, that's, Senator, through the chair, that's a question designed only to get me into trouble, as far as I can tell. So I have my own theories about that. I mean, and I've spoken publicly about this, the 850 comments, not all of those supported EPA. We think there, we haven't counted them all, but I think there are a couple hundred thousand of them that actually said that this study was not adequate. And most of those comments were generated by pushing a button on an environmental organization's website. And at least one environmental organization brought in a whole series of comments they'd actually collected from another issue. And EPA actually extended the comment time the second time because we were actually for a while ahead in the comments. So it's a game. EPA, you know, we have evidence now as a result of documents that we received through Freedom of Information Act requests. You know, they've always said this started when they got the petition from the tribes in Southwest Alaska in May of 2010. We have evidence that this whole thing started in 2008, was driven by somebody I think you know pretty well, Phil North, that Lisa Jackson, the administrator of EPA, was briefed on this in January of 2010, 5 months before they got the petition. In the briefing that she got, there was talk about the use of preemptive veto as a tool for sort of zoning that EPA could do. And this whole time we have evidence that EPA was collaborating with our opposition. When Administrator Jackson came to Alaska in July of 2010 and met with us, she'd had that petition since May. She never told us about it. And we have evidence that they wanted to try to hush it up, that they did not want to talk about it publicly when they were in Alaska. We found out it by accident because of an article in the LA Times. In terms of what's going on, I mean, it's big money. I mean, that's driving some of this. I mean, there's a lot of money involved, millions of dollars, that these organizations. So if you go to the Natural Resources Defense Council, which has an annual budget of, I don't know, $60 or $80 million a year, they need to have issues like this. They need to have Robert Redford writing my sister and writing my wife saying that I'm about to destroy the world as we know it. And that's how they raise money. You know, how do we have a better discussion about issues like this? I mean, the way we were doing it was going village to village every year, bringing in the elders that we thought were the important part of that, and it takes time. You know, you're never going to have 100% agreement on any of these kinds of projects. I mean, I think you go to NANA and, you know, I don't know what the percentage would be. It would be a very, very high percentage of people that think Red Dog has been a great thing up there. Even in Kivalina, my guess is if they took a vote, the majority would say, yeah, this has been a good thing. But there are some people that just don't like the project, and they've been captured by Trustees for Alaska and other environmental groups who've now, you know, and they litigate everything. It's not easy. And, you know, an industry, of course, has caused some of this. I'm not blaming the whole thing. I mean, first of all, you know, the industry has created problems. And the mining industry, if you look at its past, before the environmental laws started to take in effect, and those laws were driven by environmental groups. They were laws that have changed the country for the positive. You know, the record before that is very bad. There's, you know, not 100% bad. I mean, even in this state, you go back to Kennecott at the turn of the century where there was no environmental laws, and what's that? It's the headwaters of the Copper River. So it's just not easy. I've always thought that, you know, you could have a rational discussion with most people. For the most part, when I talk one-on-one with people or in small groups, the conversation, even with people that are opposed to us, are rational. But when you start to gin up the kind of effort that's gone into stopping Pebble, then I think we get into irrational discussions that actually don't lead to positive outcomes for anybody.
Good. Well, thank you. We actually have another bill coming up, and so I hate to cut this short. Senator French, did you have a question? Just wanted to... You look like you might have had a question. I just didn't...
I've had several, but I, okay. I recognize we're running a little short on time, and so I'll save it. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much for being here. To Senator, as you're leaving the table, I'll just mention Senator Machiki. I don't know if you noticed, but Senator Coghill has filed a FOIA request to the EPA on the documents that Mr. Shively was referring to on Pebble, and so that should be interesting. Our next topic is actually sort of along these same lines, only different. We're going to hear HJR 30, which is the Eisenbeck Land Exchange. Representative Herron is the sponsor, and he's coming forward to present his bill. This, again, is a public safety issue that we are getting blocked by the federal government for. So welcome, Representative Herron.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon. Bob Herron, House District 37, South Bering Sea, and it does include King Cove and Cold Bay. Madam Chair, before I talk directly to about the proposed legislation before you, is that, of course, over many years, there's been several deaths related to medevacs, and so... this is a true story, is that King Cove is experiencing 60-mile-an-hour winds today. There is a 270-foot Bering Sea trawler in port with an injured fisherman. Severe eye injury requires medevac to Anchorage immediately. Coast Guard will not go into King Cove at the time. The trawler will not go over to Cold Bay because of the rough seas. And so if the winds die down a bit... the Coast Guard will go from Cold Bay to the end of the Eisenbeck King Cove Road to the edge of the refuge, the south side of the refuge, 17 miles away from King Cove, and maybe they can medevac that fisherman back to Cold Bay to go into Anchorage. Now, this is just happening today, this afternoon, and it's happened many, many times. And so... And, of course, in the backup that staff has provided to you, just a couple of notes is that they talk about the road. Everybody's been talking about the road and how it's going to harm the black brant and the eelgrass. Well, the road is by the coordinating agencies, the feds, including Fish and Wildlife, state, local, the tribes. They worked on this for 4 years to develop a corridor. And the eelgrass, the closest the road can get to a single blade of eelgrass is 1/2 mile. And of course, in the Congressional Act, the land trade is 300-1, the value of 206 versus the 61,000 acres that we are willing to trade. The Alaska Native tribes and the state government, we're willing to trade so that we could have a public safety, as you said, Madam Chair, a public safety only corridor. And we think it's the best thing that can happen. There are no alternatives. They've been vetted and they've been tried, and this will work. Again, the coordinating agencies, including Fish and Wildlife, they submitted an environmental impact statement saying such, that a road makes the most sense. Alaska Fish and Wildlife, the agency that is up here in Alaska, they agreed. And they were as surprised as anybody that someone upstairs with a higher pay grade denied it in no action. So when Salazar, Secretary Salazar, and then, of course, Secretary Jewell made the same decision, no action on the proposed swap, and no action on, of course, the road. And, Madam Chair, if I could just quote here, is Fish and Wildlife publicly stated safety considerations are important, but they are not a factor in the decision, at least not a factor we analyze, since we only analyze the environmental impact to do, which we are called upon to do so since we're not a public safety organization. That's an oxymoron. It's an outrageous statement. How many times have you seen a fish and wildlife officer packing a weapon. Well, he's there for public safety, both for the humans and the animals. But what's so incredible, incredulous about that is that all federal agencies, had they been told by the courts, there's been congressional acts that do the same thing, is that all federal decisions must consider the human factor. Fish and Wildlife is not exempt from that fact. So I would charge that they violated the law, and more importantly, they violated their trust responsibility to Alaska Natives who live in that part of the state. It's amazing that they're so cavalier about it. And what's also incredulous is they have not delivered the public interest finding that the Congress required them to do. So it's stated in the resolution, all these facts over and over. But the bottom line is, Madam Chair, is Fish and Wildlife and this Secretary of the Interior, they do not understand what a trust responsibility is. It is not a limitation on Alaska Natives' freedom and rights. It is a limit on the federal government's power over Alaskans, and specifically a limit on the United States Department of Interior's power over Alaskan Natives. Madam Chair, there is a presumption of revealability. Sure, we can sue them, and probably King Cove will if they come to a real dead end to this road. And, Madam Chair, what happens when the federal government goes to court, most of the time, the courts are very liberal in the trust responsibility. Now, Madam Chair, your comments that we're going to move on to another piece of legislation, this is indicative of the way we're being treated in other areas, other arenas. So, Madam Chair, I appreciate the unanimous vote on the other side and then the many sponsors on this side, but it really isn't about specifically our outrageous treatment by the federal government. It's about Alaskans standing up for other Alaskans, and we're going to get it eventually. And I appreciate our congressional delegations being so adamant about it and using every tool in their toolbox to convince the Obama administration that humans are important and you have a trust responsibility for Alaska Natives.
Very good. Thank you. Questions for Representative Herron? Okay, seeing none. Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think you did a very good job outlining this resolution, and I couldn't concur more.
Senator?
Very good. We have two people on the phone to testify, so let's open public testimony. First, in King Cove, I see Henry Mack, the mayor of King Cove. Mayor Mack, can you hear us?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and then give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Giesel and members of the Senate Resource Committee. My name is Henry Mack. I'm the mayor of the city of King Cove and a lifelong resident. Thank you for this opportunity today to comment on House Joint Resolution 30. Thank you for the overwhelming support of the Alaska legislature of this issue, eventually leading to the approval of the one-lane gravel road connecting King Cove to the all-weather Cove Bay Airport. Some of you may have read my response last week to the Audubon Society's concern that this road will impact the well-being of migrating birds in the Eisenbach Refuge. It is good that I have thick skin, since much has been said about bird varieties, bird habitats, bird hunters, and bird diets, birds coming and going, yet no mention of us, year-round human residents. King Cove is a town of 960 people. We claim title to thousands of years of stewardship over this refuge, and yet we were nowhere to be found in Audubon's concerns. As mayor and as an Aleut, this omission stinks. This approval process has been a long time in the making. I was on the city council back in 1976 when we adopted our first resolution identifying the need for this road to access the Cold Bay Airport. Since that time, 12 people have been killed flying in and out of King Cole. Countless other relatives, friends, have had their lives impacted being medevaced out of King Cole. I just can't believe we are still dealing with the federal government over this basic quality of life issue for our residents, when the incredible offer to trade 60,000 acres of state and King Cove Corporation lands to the federal government for 206 acres of Eisenbach refuge lands so that we could have a 9-mile one-lane road access to the Cold Bay Airport. Residents here in King Cove thought we were finally going to be successful. Then 2 days before Christmas, this past year, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell said no. As some of you would expect, the entire community was and still is outraged. Her decision quite honestly implies that the lives of our residents are not very important to her or to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Adding further insult to her decision was a very flawed and biased EIS, which the federal government has used to justify this unbelievable decision. Secretary Jules has further insulted us by saying that the marine landing craft would work better than a road in transporting our sick and injured residents to Cold Bay. This position shows absolutely no federal government awareness of the extreme weather and marine navigable issues in this western end of the Alaska Peninsula. As Representative Bob Herron just mentioned about the catcher processor that came in here this morning at 10:30, he got here at 11:30 this morning, and the weather was just severely nasty. The Coast Guard didn't want to try to lift the injured person off the boat, so the weather was too severe in Cold Bay. The skipper did not want to take the vessel in there. It's actually a 370-foot vessel. He didn't want to take it in there because of the severity of the weather and get to the dock. So he brought the person here to King Cove. The gentleman was at our clinic until 3:30 this afternoon. The weather finally came down enough that the Coast Guard felt safely enough to come in and pick him up. The med people just stopped in the office here shortly ago. The Coast Guard picked the gentleman up and took him to Cold Bay to get on Guardian Life flight. The gentleman stayed in our clinic here for 5 hours. We could have him in Cold Bay in a couple hours. Could have been Anchorage even before the helicopter got here to get him out here. So that's why we really need this road. This gentleman is hired out of Seattle, so this road touches people nationwide. Finally, we have asked Secretary Jules to reconsider her decision. So far, she has not responded to our request, which we made in mid-January. I have personally told Secretary and her senior staff at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that we will never give up on this issue until we have the right decision. In closing, I respectfully ask you to approve this resolution. It clearly expresses our needs, frustrations, emotions, and expectations on this very critical issue to all residents of King Cove and reaches far beyond, helping the gentleman out today. Thank you again to the Alaska State Legislature and the Governor Parnell's administration for standing strong and committed to us on this very critical Eisenbach issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mayor. Very excellent presentation. Thank you. With you, I believe, is Gary Henai, the city administrator of the city of King Cove. Are you there, Gary?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Welcome. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Okay. My name is Gary Hennig, and I've been I'm the city administrator for the city of King Cove. and I've been actively involved with this effort to connect the community of King Cove to the Cold Bay Airport since the early 1980s when I worked for DOT. And since 1989, I've been the city administrator for King Cove, and during these past 25 years, this road issue has dominated my time. Now, I am more stoked than ever before on this road finally happening. We are not there yet, but with the passion and commitment from Senator Murkowski and the steadfast support from the Alaska Legislature and the Parnell administration, I am convinced it will happen. In support of this resolution, I would like to briefly summarize a couple key events of our trip to D.C. last week, which, by the way, has been my 21st trip to D.C. on this Eisenbeck issue since the early 1990s. The first part of the conversation that I want to share was with Kip Knutson. Many of you know Kip as the governor's point person in Washington, D.C. Kip was actually taking quite a bit of pride in relaying the message that the secretary had encountered him in another meeting a week prior, and that she came over and told Kip that he needs to tell Senator Murkowski to get beyond this Eisenbeck Road thing. Kip, as I mentioned, seemed quite pleased, and all he could do was tell the secretary that she could resolve this issue on her own by approving the land exchange. And until that point in time arrives, the senator will never get over it, nor should she. We spent considerable time with Senator Murkowski on our trip, and with Secretary Jewell, as well as Senator Begich. The significant comment I share with you all from Senator Jewell are two comments. One was a picture of the secretary along with Senator Lisa, Mayor Henry Mack, Representative Bob Heron, and all 100 kids in the King Cove School on the day when Senator Jewell, along with Senator Murkowski, visited us in the end of August. And Senator Jewell would not even look at that picture. And we found that to be very insulting, and we're not sure if it's because when the picture was given to her by Mayor Stanley Mack, who's the mayor of the Illusions East Borough, he pointed out to the secretary that this is why this issue is never going to go away. These are our kids, and Mayor Stanley reminded the secretary that 8 of them were his grandkids, and that the commitment of this community to make life better for the following generations in the form of a reliable and predictable transportation access is what it is all about. Again, she would not even look at the photo, and we found that very disturbing. The other thing, later in the meeting, she said, this community needs to come together and you need to find an alternative that works, anything but a road. To which we politely said, Madam Secretary, this community has come together for a long time. The only alternative that will work, that will have the degree of reliability, dependability, and affordability, is a road. Anything less than that simply doesn't work. I think that's probably all I really need to say about the trip. I would reinforce what Mayor Henry Mack said, is that the continuing support of the Alaska Legislature, the Parnell administration, is very significant. There's a lot of heartfelt feelings in the community knowing that this is a common sense matter for Alaskans, and we truly appreciate those of you in elected offices and in appointed offices, and particularly Representative Heron doing what he's been doing on our behalf, that our hearts are indebted, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hinnie. Any questions for Gary? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else on the line that would like to testify on the resolution? Is there anyone else in the room that wishes to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Closing remarks, Representative Heron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, of course, the mayor and the city administrator just told you the facts. A couple of things I'd like to share with you just so you can sense the irony in this decision that was made by this federal official. Is when we were in King Cove, first it was at the school, the kids got a chance to make a plea to her, and then we went to the community hall. And in both times, she got up at the end, and she says, I've listened to your concerns. Now I'm going to go listen to the animals. And so when her decision came back is that, you know, we are doing this for the black brant. We're doing it for the animals that are out there. But if you, in the backup, you have, of course, the bag limits on our refuges, and I went to it, and I didn't know this was here. And in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge, it's world famous for black bunting, brown bear hunting. It's world famous for waterfowl and ptarmigan. And they do an incredible job of getting people up there to do all this hunting. And what's incredulous about this is, and I've said incredulous way too many times today, is that it says that hardy waterfowlers can hunt in the eelgrass to pursue and achieve their daily bag limit of black brant and search for ptarmigan on the upland year-round. So they want them to go into the eelgrass to hunt, but they don't want a road that's in the upland a half a mile from the eelgrass for a safety corridor. So since the resolution has passed the other body, I've, of course, gotten some nastygrams from people. And they just can't believe that we would want to harm those birds. And I had this one gentleman tell me that this choke point needs to be saved for all the subsistence hunters in the lower 48 and in western Alaska. And then he had it all predicted out that the average family needs 60 to 100 pounds of bird for their freezers. But a white person, anybody, not even a characterization of their ethnic group, ethnicity, is that you can bag 51 birds a day while you're up there hunting an Eisenbeck. 51. Two of them being black brant. So it's so I've sent back to this one individual that she didn't like me promoting this legislation for my constituents. But she only knows half the story. She doesn't know the human factor. And so, Madam Chair, that's my closing statement.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Questions for Representative Herron? All right. With that, I will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Joint Resolution 30, amended, version 28LS153/A. From committee with individual recommendations and attached zero.
Thank you. Is there objection? Seeing none, the bill passes out of this, the resolution passes out of this committee. Thank you very much, Representative Herron. And I think this is these were both great topics to have on Seward Day, a day when a visionary man worked hard to make that purchase of Alaska, swimming upstream to do it. Congress certainly wasn't backing him on that, but eventually passed it. So these are both examples of resources that we need to continue to fight for. We will adjourn now. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, and on Wednesday we have a couple bills before us, HB 161, Auctions for Big Game Harvest Permits, and the first hearing of HB 268, Big Bull Moose Derbies. So at this time we will adjourn. The time is 5 p.m. Thank you.